A few years ago, during our annual 3-week retreat at the Chaswa Monastery in the Sagaing Hills of Burma, a few of us were taken by the abbot that we co-teach with to a more remote monastery north along the Irrawaddy River. Back up into the Sagaing Hills, more secluded. Along with us was the Venerable Usumana, who was translating at that Chaswa retreat. And as is often customary during these retreats the last 9 years, we've been very lucky to be taken to great teachers, Sayamas, nuns, or Sayadaws, monks, shortly before they pass on. This was one such instance. He was 100 years old. He was also blind, and he could barely hear. So when we were being, he was just sitting there walking into the room. Felt like walking into light. The space was filled with metta, compassion, joy, and a serene, profound equanimity. He just sat there sensing everything, somehow really acutely. To be introduced to us, his attendant had to yell in his ear so loud that it was piercing to one's own ear. One felt like putting their fingers in their ears. "This is Stephen Smith from Hawaii." And he'd say, "What?" And it would be repeated. And likewise with Usumana, who was Jake then, and a couple of other co-teachers from Australia. I don't know how long we were there. It was quite a timeless space as these connections often are. But one at a time, he had each of us come forward to where he was sitting, and he'd reach out his hand to take and feel our hands. And simultaneously, I felt in his hands both the warmth of metta and the coolness of serenity and metta too, like a cool metta, serene, unconditional love, just through his hands. And it just sent shivers through my body. And at the end, before we left, however long it was, a few hours perhaps, he then had each of us come up again and made a blessing. Very simple blessing, like a metta blessing. He said, "May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from even one unskillful mind moment." That was it. It was just such a pervading blessing that I felt speechless all the way back to the monastery at Chaswa. I don't know what his practice was, but the result, either the path to it was paved with metta, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, or certainly it's a result of Vipassana practice as well. One comes to these Brahma Viharas from either way. It can be the platform out of which one practices to the Vipassana insights and liberation. And it's certainly the quality of mind and heart arising from liberation, or liberating, deep liberating insights. But tonight, just to provide a large context, a bigger picture, I want to talk about these, what are sometimes called the four immeasurables, apamanya, or the Brahma Vihara. Brahma Vihara is meaning divine abidings, Brahma divine, Vihar dwelling or abiding. It's the sense of, as I was saying in the instructions yesterday morning, to the original teachings of the Buddha, the earliest discourses were simply to call up the metta, abide in it, abide in the mind-heart glow of metta, and pervade it. So this has significant meaning even in the definition, divine abiding. We're learning how to peel the layers off of the heart, away from the heart. The layers are barriers of separation, numbing out to feelings, protective layers of fear, of anger, and so forth. Just the crust that can grow over, like barnacles, over the nature of the heart. And as we build up a safe enough external container and internalize that, it feels safe enough to let those crusty old barnacles start to break up and fall away. And we have left this raw energy of unconditional love, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, which are themselves powerful protectors. We can discard the old ones, the ones we brought into our lives when our wisdom was young. Every wholesome mind moment of consciousness, all these seeds of the Brahma Viharas are there. And that's why we can immediately begin this meditation by picking one of the seeds of the metta seed, the form of metta in our mind stream, and make it the subject of meditation. And it grows that seed, it makes it stronger and stronger, and it opposes the opposite of metta, resentment and fear, aversion, ill will, anger. And as long as that keeps, we keep focused on that, those opposing states don't enter that moment of consciousness. And when they do, and we notice that, and we're able to return to the focus on the metta seed, these oppositional forces naturally fall away. These four states in the Pali metta and compassion, in the Pali karuna, empathetic joy is mudita, and equanimity or balance of mind is upeka. We could call them the most sublime, most spiritual of our emotional body, of our emotional life. Very powerful and purifying emotions. They're emotions to pursue, to develop. And that's why practices have been made of them. In fact, these practices were a part of the Indian life long before the Buddha came. And when the Buddha had his realization of the middle path, through insight, he merely incorporated the Brahma Vihara practices as a way leading to insight and as a way of life, and pointed out that these qualities are the expression of either a moment's liberated mind or the liberated mind. that is the nature of the heart, is compassion and love and joy and equanimity. So the very refined levels of mind, and they begin, as we know, as we see, in sort of in fleeting ways. They're mixed. You know, we see what's called the near and far enemies of metta, what looks like metta, a masquerade of metta, but some form of conditionality or attachment. Whereas the true metta is, there's no wanting there. It's not any kind of a wanting love or a love with expectation or possessive love or self-referencing love. So it feels pure, it feels restful. It feels like home. Brahma-vihara, divine or sacred abode, divine home. It feels like that. Whereas the various forms of expectation or condition or attached love, you know, it's not quite that feeling. There's a bit of anxiety there. And then we become really familiar, as is part of the practice, with, you know, the purging, purifying element that lifts up these crusty coverings, the fear and the aversion, the ill will, very much a natural part of the practice. And wisdom is gained and metta grows by facing these states, not condemning them, not demonizing them. Every so often, we get a scent or a taste of the luminous mind that for a moment is completely at rest in the respective Brahma-vihara. So that is that's when metta grows to such a strength that it's matured into the Brahma-vihara. It feels effortless. It seems superfluous to even use phrases or to use categories. There is simply this deep and natural and strong abiding. And it's effortless that it pervades out. It's the generosity nature of unconditional love. Its nature is to spread, to connect. We could call these Brahma-viharas all relational practices, or practices of connectedness. They reveal the deep and profound interconnectedness of all beings, all of life. It's nothing we figure out. It's just revealed. And so at those moments where, you know, that luminosity, that brilliance arises, it's such a gift. It feels like, you know, grace. But in fact, it's just the natural mind, heart, as it is. And we're at rest in it. And its nature is to go out unconditionally in all directions. We also, you know, fortunately have the form where we can work, you know, categorically with the strongest metta subjects. So we begin where it feels right, as Michelle was talking about last night. A benefactor or a dear friend or ourselves, wherever we can, that gets the ember going. And then through the spirit of repetition, of continuously applying the mind, inclining the mind, or if you use phrases, or holding on to the felt sense or visualizations, that's like fanning the flame. You know, and then it continues to grow. In the Majjhima Nikaya, one of the what's known as the middle course, middle length discourses of the Buddha, a householder named Dasama asked Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and his personal attendant the last 25 years of the Buddha's teaching and his life. Dasana asked him if there was one practice that can liberate the mind, destroy the harmful influences, and yield the unsurpassable freedom from bondage. And Ananda said, yes, I can name 11 of them right now, but I'll tell you just one. And he said, a bhikkhu, it's all of us who practice, a bhikkhu who continuously relates to the beings in one direction with a mind endowed with love, then likewise to the beings in the second, third, and fourth direction, and in the same way to the beings above, below, across, and all around, she continuously relates everywhere and equally to the entire world of beings with a mind endowed with unconditional love, a mind that is untroubled, that's free from anger, that's vast, that's enlarged, that's measureless. Then she reflects in this way, even this liberation of the mind, which is love, is produced and intended. And whatever is produced and intended is impermanent and is subject to cessation. In understanding in this way, he becomes established in this moment and in this understanding, and all are certain of the obstructions or influences are eliminated, the harmful influences. And therefore, this is one of the descriptions of using a Brahma-vihara such as metta as one's path to liberation. One can do it in a sitting, in a retreat over one's lifetime, that it becomes the main, one's main sort of primary meditation subject, doing the metta, directing it out, building it up to such a degree of concentration, the mind becomes untroubled. And agitation falls away. And then one reflects on the very consciousness of metta with mindfulness, with insight, and sees its impermanent nature, its selfless nature. And such an insight can have a irreversible transformation of consciousness where some degree are all degrees of attachment, aversion and delusion fall away. It's a path of Dhamma pleasures and healing and empowerment, one that we should all know about, one that was commonly practiced in the time of the Buddha, and many traditions today, including in Burma, use this as a basis. The four Brahma-viharas are often used in analogy to having four children, and the parent relating to the baby, as Michelle was describing last night, the mother cow would relate to a newborn. This naturally, without effort, without thought, instinctively care for it unconditionally, even though it's crying and pooping and keeping us up all night or whatever. We just feel that love. Likewise, the parent with a newborn child feels the same way. The second child may be sickly, and the response to that child is one of tender compassion, a response of care to their suffering. You know, not negativity, not aversion, not fear of that suffering, but total presence and love in the form of compassion, love in the form of that what touches pain or suffering. And a third child may be you know, kind of hitting their stride on their own, individuating from their parents and finding their own successes in their life at school or socially or in sports or art and whatnot. That's the love of a parent for the child enjoying success. And the fourth is that a child that now is leaving home, you know, after they've grown up and gone to school and, you know, spent sufficient time at home, which these days can be 20, 25, 30, 35, or 40. And, you know, finally they go off on their own and the parents can at last let them follow their own path with equanimity. They're going to meet their joys and sorrows, you know, according to their own actions, according to natural law. And there's that no lack of feeling for their suffering, no lack of feeling for their joys, their successes. But also this calm acceptance and, you know, and usually a wise non-interference their lives. Metta we might experience as a radiant quality in the mind, a bright quality psychologically, as a tender feeling. Some people were describing in today's interviews, you know, a softness around the heart. Some people described it more kinesthetically, you know, in the body, light tingly feelings. Others more that brightness of mind, or as an attitude, you know, that I'm okay just as I am, or the person they're sending the metta to, you know, it, when it's the moments that it's not conditional that we send that love, they don't have to change and be something else to be worthy, to be deserving of the love, but rather, you know, may you be happy just as you are, or at peace with things just as they are. That's how we cultivate unconditional love now. That's how we make it so pure here and now. This kind of metta is free of likes and dislikes, of preferences. There's already an element of equanimity in the metta when it's pure. It's very balanced. There's an openness, a sense of oneness, and an experience of our own deep kindness. And we also experience that in return. When we experience metta from others, we feel an openness, we feel a oneness, we feel a kindness toward us. We both recognize the goodness in other people, and it's very affirming when we sense someone recognizing the goodness within us, our core goodness, our core preciousness. Karuna, or compassion, could be described as a fearless presence in the face of suffering. I remember at my dad's, when my dad was the last moments of his life. It was kind of unexpected. You know, he was dying a slower death and a more ugly death by cancer. But he had a heart attack. And so, you know, there I was, at first kind of panicking and calling in nurses and doctors. He's in the hospital. In fact, we were going to take him home the next day. And he said he just felt something in his stomach, and then he took a long, indescribable look into my mother's eyes, took an in-breath, and that was it. There was no out-breath. Just the body succumbed. And, you know, I felt all kinds of feelings. I felt panic, and I felt grief, and I also felt the significance and importance of the moment, of the transition. And I garnered up everything in my practice mind and was present, just made myself fearlessly present for something I had never been so close to, so that I could also feel gratitude. I could also talk to him and spend an hour and a half in the room, you know, and sort of guiding him out and doing metta, finishing saying what I needed to say, you know, to him. Luckily, I had had the last 8 months of being able to look after him and learned about that quality of being present so that he wasn't uncomfortable. It's kind of hard sometimes with one's parent. So you get scared and you want him to be well and you want him to be a certain way. Same with a child. But they feel that energy. So, you know, true compassion is without aversion or without fear. Those are the near enemies. And as free as possible from the suffering and grief. Suffering and grief certainly arise. But we need to feel them and still maintain that powerful and fearless presence. And that's what let my dad be open. Let me change him, you know, and hug him again, kiss him again, which I hadn't since I was 12, and comfort him, massage him, and so forth. It's also, karuna is the same experience, you know, when we're suffering. We don't want to feel people there who are agitated and uncomfortable, can't wait to leave, you know, or the sense of them feeling pity toward us. It doesn't feel good, then we just as soon have them go, you know. Don't you need to go to lunch now or something? You know, get out of here. But someone who's really totally there and just and a witness to and empathic to our suffering, feeling it, you know it. There's no question. You know if they're there or not. This is what makes a vast difference in the healing professions between, you know, a healing professional, doctor or nurse, who has that quality of compassion, who has that presence, versus one who's just, it's for them, they could just as well be a mechanic. So this karuna, sense of care, of being cared for, in the last years, my dad died about 7 years ago. My mom's gone steadily downhill. And at first, I really needed her to be a certain way, you know. As dementia began to set in, I'd first be impatient. I'd want her to remember things. I wouldn't want her to keep repeating things. It was kind of frustrating, and I didn't like it. I knew I didn't like it, and I had to work really hard at times, you know, needing her to be different, trying to convince her that she already said what she said or didn't need to be talking in these sort of delusional ways. Now, I feel mudita when I'm around her. I feel this empathetic joy. I've learned to be the parent. She's the child. And I love going over there, and, you know, she loves being pampered. And she's still able to be at home. She knows that she's at home. And, you know, I make jokes when she's talking delusional things. She lives on the ocean, and the house sits on, you know, a cement foundation. Under that is just huge boulders, and then the ocean a few feet down. And she's been talking lately about, you know, there's a downstairs place here. Okay, Mom, and tell me that every few days. And I was home a week ago, and just again saying, you know, should we go downstairs? And I said, well, actually, you know, Mom, Chandra, my daughter, and Michelle's stepdaughter, she helped to raise, Chandra's coming this summer. She can stay down there. And then we'll all go down there and enjoy the room downstairs. And she talks about this field that we can walk to out there. Well, out there is the ocean. And I said, okay, Mom, but we have to put on our bathing suits and our swim fins. And she'll just laugh. She'll get somehow that she's a little off, you know. And because I'm not resistant to it, she'll just laugh. And I'm sort of taking delight in her graciousness, in her appreciation. Every day she says how lucky she feels to be at home, to be cared for. She's 93 now. So mudita is that unfettered, profound joy in just being. And particularly it's the empathic enjoyment of others' joy in being, or others' success, others' accomplishment. And feeling that when it's directed toward ourselves. You know, we are raised in a culture with heavy stress on competitiveness and comparing and getting ahead and, you know, succeeding at the expense of others. And it actually breeds envy and jealousy, which happen to be the far enemy of empathetic joy. Comparing, envy, jealousy. So it's such a delight and such a transformation of a lot of our emotional condition patterning to be able to both feel appreciation for others' joy and to feel appreciated. You know, when we're happy and when we're successful and doing well with what we love. That's mudita. Chandra, by the way, and this is, you know, with her permission, when it's helpful to people, went through a few really difficult years with addiction. And it got to where we were all quite scared. And every time a phone rang in the middle of the night, you know, it was jarring and many sleepless nights. And a real effort and energy to get it together and provide a moment for her to make a choice to be helped or not, and for her to choose that, to be helped, go through a treatment program, and, you know, now a couple years later, really, really flourishing. And I helped her register last year in Boulder, Colorado, at the, you know, she still has a couple, well, now 1 year of university left, to register at the Naropa School, where 30 years ago, at its very opening, I was introduced to this practice. Kind of full circle. She's doing wonderful. She's getting all A's and, you know, involved in yoga and drama and writing and just really having, really flourishing. It's a beautiful moment to feel mudita for her now. So when the ground of love touches suffering, one might feel one's heart quiver in genuine empathic response. When this ground of love, of metta, touches delight, joy, one might feel their heart dance in celebration, in resonance with the person's happiness. Upeka is equanimity, non-reactiveness, non-attachment, all the same. You hear all these words used. It's just a real serene acceptance or wideness of mind that holds the continuum of joy and sorrow, changing all the time, experienced all the time, every moment, every day, and throughout our lives, in ourselves, in our loved ones, in all beings on the planet. Everyone is subject to experiencing tremendous joy, tremendous sorrow. Equanimity is that wide mind that understands, is able to hold it all without being reactive. So reactive would mean aversion, dislike to what's unpleasant, what's painful. And it would be grasping, attachment, clinging to what's pleasant, what's successful, you know, what is a gain. and not a loss. Either way, that reactiveness is a closing of the heart and mind. We shut down a great degree of life as it is. Non-reactiveness, it's not always so pleasant, but we're really in touch with things as they are. We're really in touch with our own and others' lives. In that way, our empathy, our love, our compassion is all the more strong and pure and fearless and present. The equanimity is an essential, it's the rudder that navigates us through our lives. And the purest metta, the purest karuna, compassion, the purest mudita, empathetic joy, arises from this kind of equanimity. The far enemy, reactiveness. The near enemy looks like equanimity, but it's indifferent. It's not caring. It's insensitive. It's disconnected. Authentic equanimity is deeply, profoundly connected, intimately connected, sensitive, caring. And sometimes just a subtle but crucial difference, and what knows the difference is wisdom, you know, and the practice of it. So all these Brahmaviharas, they're quite fluid, dynamic emotions in us. They expand our life. They connect. They're immediate responses to things as they are. You know, we don't have to calculate. In practice, it's like a training ground, kind of sussing out, you know, the seed of metta, the seed of joy, the seed of compassion, and so forth, and giving it attention, because it's a powerful practice to do and to put our awareness singularly on that quality enhances it and immediately allows us to deal with its opposites or its masquerades. So we're in an intensive, that's why this is called intensive, you know, practice, intensive meditation. We're in a pressure cooker. You know, we're all wearing magnifying glasses. Everything we're seeing really close up, and, you know, it's kind of hard to operate our denial systems here when we're wearing these magnifying glasses and when we're sitting with nothing to do and walking with nothing to do. Our escape routes become, you know, more and more challenging. They're limited to lunch and the bulletin board and the labels on our shampoo. You know, that's how we start to busy our mind if we can. These Brahmaviharas, because we're practicing them all under the context of the Vipassana, that is the wisdom practice, they are not I-centered responses to life. You know, we begin to see this the selfless nature of love, even when it's toward ourselves, and the wisdom in compassion. It's not about oneself. We're not invested in an ego-centered way of getting rid of someone's compassion. We want them to be free, but we know that even if we cannot remove their suffering, that our very genuine presence there is an alleviation of their identification to their suffering, because we're not identified with it. Likewise, with the mudita and equanimity, they're not I-centered responses, emotional responses to life. They're selfless responses to life, and therefore they dissolve. Often we find a kind of dissolution of the subject-object duality in our experience. When someone passes away in Burma, in the Buddhist tradition, often you'll find two very complementary but maybe seemingly opposite responses. And one is to chant, a chant about how all things are impermanent and pass away. You know, like when the great Mahasi Sayadaw passed away about 8 months after I was ordained by him, there were 300,000 people who had come from all over Burma to Rangoon to attend his funeral procession. And all the great monasteries had sent nuns and monks who were chanting this sutta on anicca, how whatever is born or whatever is created or whatever arises has the nature to pass away. You know, and having this understanding releases the heart. It's a very sobering response to death. But also, they'll chant the Metta Sutta, you know, which you all chant every night. I took some of my father's ashes to Burma in 1997. And just before a retreat there at the Chaswell Monastery, we went out in the Sayadaw, the abbot's boat, about 30 of us, 20 yogis and 10 nuns from one of the nearby nunneries that our project supports. And that's exactly what they did. They were first chanting an anicca chant, you know, that just as my father, you know, came into this world and was born, you know, so too would he age and decay and pass away. And there's a certain beauty in just saying the truth, just as it is. And equally a beauty in the loving kindness, chanting the loving kindness sutta. Beautiful thing. You know, sort of Dhamma tears, taste of grief, but also immense gratitude and that that wide heart that develops from understanding. One might wonder what effects this practice has. You know, you can see it in two major ways. We have a week to do this particular practice, most of us. And one application of doing the metta as we're doing it, as a meditation, is strengthening the parami of metta, that is, the spiritual virtue of it. It's bringing about concentration because we're focused on the metta. Concentration may grow, you know, deep enough to be a great basis for those of you going on into the Vipassana next week. But being concentrated and the continuation throughout the day of practicing metta and maybe some of these other Brahma Viharas later, it begins to percolate deep in the mind, into our thinking process, right down to the intentional level. And it will influence the way we think. It'll influence the way we speak. It'll influence the way we act with our bodies. The more we practice it, you know, the more we see in ourselves or recognize another. Well, that's bodily metta. That's vocal metta when we hear the quality of speech, the tone, the words used, our own or others. Those are, you know, metta thoughts. You know, not just to say loving kindness things, but it's the expression, you feel the expression of metta no matter what someone is saying, just in how they treat other beings. So this is the parami path of metta. Another path for those who have done a lot of metta or have a lot of time to do more or as a metta jhana, where it goes to deep levels of concentration, even absorption, that where one becomes fully absorbed, sinks into the Brahma Vihara, completely one with the metta. One can have moments of that, you know, during the week of parami practice, and at such a time where you may do a longer period of practice to do the metta jhanas, really strengthens the metta other Brahma viharas in the mind stream. You know, we really begin to more and more think out of these Brahma viharas, compassion, equanimity, joy, and so forth. Speak out of them, live out of them. Our body chemistry can change from the degree we use. You know, we know how sour we can feel if we spend a few hours with anger, you know, or jealousy, or you know, our bodies don't feel very good, and tone of our voice, you know, salty mood. Likewise, you know, imagine spending more and more time with these metta thoughts and compassionate speech and joy actions of the body and so forth. That really has a deep biochemical effect on our bodies and how we live. And sometimes we don't see it, you know, but like when you throw a stone into a pond and the ripples go out, patterns go out. Maybe you throw another stone and patterns go out, and maybe a third and then a fourth stone. And still all these patterns somehow begin to intertwine, and they still look like patterns. They still look, you know, like some amazing artistical and beautiful formation of nature. That's what happens. That's the symmetry that happens when we do things and act out of this metta. A single gift or word, a thought, some action, a single act with a good intention, a pure intention, like the rippling of the pond from throwing stones in, spreads outward invisibly in great and mysterious ways, having effects on people and on the future that and consequences that we may never even know. But sometimes we do. And sometimes we ask, you know, how are all these good things happening? How come I feel like I'm in this field of loving kindness? And, you know, that's it. That's the reason why. Somehow, somewhere along the line, you threw those good intention stones in the pond and it sent out these kinds of ripples. It's long been known that there's a connection between the Polynesian seafaring society of the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. For the present day Hawaiians, it's been 2,000 years since they arrived in Hawaii, and in the north, in the northwest, the First Nations people of Canada or Native Americans of Alaska, and probably lower down Washington and Oregon as well. And in very recent years, there's been a resurgence in the northwest coast of the heritage and health and pride in their seafaring past, largely sparked by the connection with the Hawaiians, who in the mid-70s began to reclaim their heritage, their seafaring past and culture and community and spirituality by rebuilding these double-hull canoes and sailing them back to where they came from, Marquesas and Tahiti and Rapa Nui, Easter Island. And then they wanted to build as indigenous or endemic a double-hull canoe as they could, but had no wood. It was all old, it was all rotten, it had all been logged, the koa hardwood. So they came to see this elder in Alaska, and his name was Judson Brown, and make a connection. And it's these connections and certain tools and ideas and terminologies and evidence from their chants that they know that there's been a connection. There's no physical archaeological evidence as yet. But something connected them a long time ago. And it could be even far longer than we imagine. And as I was in Siberia a couple years ago with Usumana and Chandra, and learned a little bit about the that that the, it was considered the Siberian shamans didn't necessarily only travel over the Bering Strait during a previous ice age and then down the northwest corridor, that it's thought that they also could have been sailors on canoes on the shorelines then, which would have been very different. And so who knows where the first ripples occurred, where the first stones were cast. But a friend of ours, Nainoa Thompson, the first Hawaiian navigator trained by an elder from Micronesia, met with this Judson Brown, said we're looking for wood that we can build this double hull canoe. And they were showed what they have in their forest there. And Nainoa said, well, how much would it be? And Judson Brown, the elder, said, never ask what it cost and never give back a gift, implying that it would be a gift. And something didn't feel right with Nainoa, and so he and some other crew members went back and spoke with elders in Hawaii who said, I understand why you feel this way. What you might do first is plant more koa trees, the original hardwood trees. So they planted 12,000 of them on the Big Island. And once they started growing up, they went back to see Judson, and the trees were offered, these massive, massive trees, 415 years old and 8 feet wide, and very ceremoniously, great respect, felled the trees, knowing that it had a great purpose in building community and the restoration of a past almost lost, almost forgotten. So that was done, and then they began to sail this new double hull canoe called the Hawaii Loa. And they brought it to Canada in 1995, some years after they finished building it. And from there they sailed up to Alaska into the village of Judson Brown and the community to pay their respects, to thank them. And they, went into their simple huts, and a grandmother sent her grandson out to spread a blanket and offer all the money that the village could gather, $100 bills. And again, Nainoa felt, he said, I don't know how to respond. And Judson said, young man, we measure our wealth by what we give, not by what we accumulate. And that's how our culture has survived for 12,000 years. That's why we still have these trees. And so with a great understanding of generosity and the mysterious interconnectedness of gift-giving and compassion and love, they've gone back, and it's become an awakening in the Pacific, in Polynesia, Polynesian Pacific, where now many of the Pacific Islanders are rebuilding canoes. And right now the Hokulea, the original double hull sailing canoe, is sailing as we speak in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, kind of tracking what's going on in our oceans and the wildlife and the endangered species and whatnot, all with non-instrument navigation, all by following the stars and currents and migration of birds and colors of the sky, all the turbulent systems. And they have daily satellite phone contact with school classrooms, with children, so they can bring up a new generation of people who care and go forward by knowing the past, which is what we do with our practice. We get trained in these ancient traditions of the Buddhist teachings of metta, karuna, mudita, equanimity, and the vipassana practices. We make them our own, We anchor, you know, in the lineages, and we pass them on to next generations. That's how it works. That's what a transmission is. And the next time I'll talk about these practices as a transmission of energy, as a release of energy, as an opening, how they actually heal, how they unfold knots and tangles and psychic folds within us that are both painful to hold and tremendously joyful to release, you know, a reclamation of zest and passion and energy and enthusiasm that have long been locked away. So I'll finish with Advice to Myself by Louise Erdrich. Leave the dishes. Let the celery rot in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator and an earthen scum harden on the kitchen floor. Leave the black crumbs in the bottom of the toaster. Throw the cracked bowl out and don't patch the cup. Don't patch anything. Don't mend. Buy safety pins. Don't even sew on a button. Let the wind have its way, then the earth that invades as dust, and then the dead foaming up in gray rolls underneath the couch. Talk to them. Tell them they are welcome. Don't keep all the pieces of the puzzles or the doll's tiny shoes in pairs. Don't worry who uses whose toothbrush or if anything matches at all. Accept one word to another or a thought. Pursue the authentic. Decide first what is authentic. Then go after it with all your heart. Your heart, that place you don't even think of cleaning out. Closet stuffed with savage mementos. Don't sort the paper clips from screws from saved baby teeth or worry if we were eating cereal for dinner again. Don't answer the telephone ever or weep over anything at all that breaks. Pink molds will grow within those sealed cartons in the refrigerator. Accept new forms of life. And talk to the dead who drift in through the screen windows, who collect patiently on the tops of food jars and books. Recycle the mail. Don't read it. Don't read anything except what destroys the insulation between yourself and your experience, or what pulls down, or what strikes at, or what shatters this ruse you call necessity. Appreciate in those moments when the barriers fall away the cool warmth of metta.